Oh, yeah, who is that?
Associate professor at the University of Bologna. He started studying astronomy in Padova. Then he graduated in Bologna. He moved for several years in Germany between Bremen and Hamburg, amazing city. And then he got an ERC grant called Colihau, right?
No, Mekau.
Mekau. And that on which on magnets, of course, to work at the Institute for Radio Astronomy in Bologna, where some years ago, a couple of years ago, he got the permanent position as an assistant professor. So thank you, Frank, for joining our seminar, and invite everyone to interrupt at any moment for questions, please.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for inviting me here. So I'm going to, we can keep it very like informal since we are not so many. So interrupt me anytime if you want. So I'm going to show you an overview of our latest results on the both observational and theoretical attempt of detecting the cosmic web and relating the radio signatures of the cosmic web or non-detections of the radio signatures of the cosmic web to the underlying pressing question of what's the origin of cosmic magnetism. So very short overview that was mostly thought for students maybe, but so evidences of magnetic fields in galaxies and beyond. So in our galaxy, we know since a lot of time there are magnetic fields. We can study it, of course, from within the galaxy, and two techniques we can use, for example, is we can study the synchrotron emission from relativistic electrons, and this is probing the combination of the density of relativistic electrons and the magnetic field strength squared, or we can use the Faraday rotation, in which case we need to use basically polarized background sources, either within the galaxies or outside of the galaxy, for example, pulsars, if we are using sources within the galaxy, and this is probing the combination of the magnetic field along the line of sight and the thermal electron density. Combining these techniques and others, I'm not going to review here, we know the magnetic field in the Milky Way is tangled, as a typical magnetic field was the center of 20 microgauss, currency scales smaller than a kiloparsec, and the pressure of cosmic of magnetic fields compared to the gas pressure is 100 times more. So dynamically, magnetic fields are much more important than the pressure of the hot gas. Of course, there are plenty of external galaxies we can observe through the radio emission, also in this case, synchrotron emission detected recently with the LOFAR telescopes, and also the whole picture holds. So we have a combination of regular and tangled fields, still currency scales of the order of a kiloparsec, plasma beta, so the ratio between gas and magnetic pressure, order of 1% in external galaxies. We also have, of course, jets from radio galaxies, from ejected from active galactic nuclei. In this case, depending on the timing of the event, we can have magnetic fields as high as 100 microgauss, then lobes expand into the surrounding space or even into the voids, if we are speaking of galaxies in empty regions. In this case, currency scales might be stretched out to a megaparsec, and through the dilution of magnetic fields into the surrounding environment, the plasma beta typically is of the order of one, so more or less equal pressure at some point between magnetic and thermal gas pressure. This is the most recent of a couple of days ago, spectacular discovery of possibly the largest radio galaxy so far in the sky, discovered through in the LOFAR survey. It's called Alcyoneus, and it's stretching 5 megaparsec from side to side, with the central galaxy being here, and those are the two jets. And in this case, this galaxy is in an empty field, so it's also easier for lobes to stretch out into the surrounding environment. Then we know magnetic fields are in between galaxies in the intracluster medium. So what we see here is the classic picture of the coma clusters of galaxies. So we are looking at megaparsec scales. We have a classic central source, which is called radio halo, this diffuse emission here, which we think is mostly due to Fermi 2 reacceleration mediated by turbulent motions, reaccelerating a pool of fossil relativistic electrons. And then we have more peripheral sources like this one, which are called radio relics, which are towards HAR-200 of this cluster. And they are believed to be the acceleration from shock waves. We don't know exactly where the shock is moving, but we think it's accelerating particles here, which are going to emit synchrotron emission. So in this case, the fields are 5 microgauss at most in the very center, and then they decline with radius reaching a fraction of the microgauss towards the relic region. The currency scales of the magnetic field we can infer to Faraday rotation are typically smaller than 100 kiloparsec. We know in this case, magnetic fields are subdominant respect to thermal gas, so the plasma beta is of order of 100. The pressure in magnetic fields is 100 times less than the one in hot gas. We also know since a relatively less time, like just a couple of years, that we can also have magnetic fields in between smashing galaxy clusters. So these two clusters, Abel-401 and Abel-399, which is the couple of clusters which has the highest signal-to-noise ratio in Planck, in a Planck catalog. They also host diffuse radio emission connecting the two. We know these two clusters, let's say we reasonably know these two clusters still have to merge. They are colliding for the first time. But we have all these fluffy emission patches here. You can see the same only in synchrotron here on the right. This emission is synchrotron. It's connecting from side to side the two clusters. It's stretching 3 megaparsec projected in the sky. And this is interesting because this is showing there are sizable magnetic fields of the order of a fraction of a microgauss even before clusters had time to collide and develop turbulence. The current scales we can infer are shorter than a megaparsec. Also, the plasma beta in this case is of order of 100, but it was really surprising, still surprising to find so much emission in structure before they actually merge. This is not a filament as the one I'm going to show you in the next slides, because basically the Vira radii of these two clusters are crossing here. So at most, this structure used to be a filament, but now is totally engulfed between the two Vira radii of the two clusters. We think is what used to be a filament, but now has been squeezed and stretched and compressed and possibly even made turbulence, but is not the classic filaments we would like to see in the sky. Why do we want to see the filament in the sky in the first place? So now let's collect all the observations I just showed, and we put a typical magnetic field strength, just order of magnitude on the y-axis, and a typical matter over density respect to the cosmic mean density on the x-axis. So of course, in the high density end, we have galaxies, and magnetic fields can be several tens of microgauss. Then we have galaxy clusters, and we go into the microgauss and submicrogauss regime. And then we just lack of observational data, and we actually have direct measurement, or say indirect measurement, of the magnetic fields at the periphery of galaxy clusters just for a handful of objects, even if we have more than 50 diffuse radio emission observed, for example, by Loffer in the latest survey. Then we have a valley of unknowns, basically. And then we have, on the extreme left, in the region of voids, upper limits that we can infer from the analysis of the CMB. So strictly speaking, those limits are only coming from the universe at redshift 1,100 or something. And they are coming from the non-detection of the magnetic induced perturbations on top of the CMB. So from the residual, from the allowed residual of perturbation by magnetic fields on the fit of the CMB in the, say, lambda CDM model, we can limit the possible amount of primordial magnetic fields. And this is typically turning to something of 4 nanogauss. This is only referring, strictly speaking, to redshift 1,000. But if you assume simple, into quote, MHD, we can say this is also the nowadays upper limit of magnetic fields in voids, if nothing else has enriched voids in the universe with magnetic field. And then we have lower limit here coming from the non-detection of the inverse Compton cascade emission from distant blazers. So this is a bit more convolved, but basically you expect to have a cone of secondary emission around the beamed emission from blazars. This should be visible in the gamma regime, but we don't see this extended halo of secondary emission from blazars. And not entirely solved issue, but let's say the consensus explanation for this is that if we have the tiniest magnetic field, like really 10 to the minus 14 Gauss, this would be enough to deflect this cascade of particles away from the observer. Those are originally attached to the beam jet pointing towards us, but if we have a tiny amount of magnetic field, we can deflect and disperse the secondary cascade of particles, and this would make the inverse Compton cascade emission from blazars disappear. So using the non-detection of this effect, we can put lower limit of the order of 10 to the minus 7 microGauss, 10 to the minus 8 microGauss, depending on the object. In between, we have basically no direct detection or upper limits. I'm going to show some statistical ones in this talk. And if we turn this into an estimate on the volume of the universe for which we know what is the magnetic field, basically for 99.99% of the cosmic volume, we ignore what is the magnetic field, or we have orders and orders of magnitude of ignorance. This is important because this is connected to our still ongoing ignorance of what's the origin of extragalactic magnetic fields. So in principle, we can explain the magnetic fields that are measured in clusters of galaxies, so up to megaparsec from the center of galaxy cluster, either using a purely astrophysical origin scenario, in which we think magnetic fields were injected by galaxy formation-related processes. So we have the formation of compact objects that are releasing currents into the plasma, either via jets in the case of AGNs, or can be the magnetized wind from supernovae, or the collective effect of star formation winds from the entire galaxy, and so on. On the other opposite spectrum of scenario, we can have purely primordial mechanism in which we can think there was a tiny magnetic field still that has to be compatible with Planck limits, but it was already there either during generated during inflation or soon after that. It's there, it's tiny, but there are some reason to believe there might have been a primordial magnetic field, and that magnetic field got compressed, advected within structure, and then amplified. And of course, if we can assess once for all that the magnetic fields on the larger scale are coming from an astrophysical or a primordial scenario, this can really trigger development in one of the two directions. For example, if we were to discover magnetic fields implied by observation must have a primordial origin, it means we have to find a mechanism that can produce them, for example, during inflation. And this is also, this would contribute to an additional energy term one has to include while doing cosmology, for example. Very small, but it should be there, for example. Or vice versa, if we are sure those are entirely coming from astrophysical origin, we must relate them, for example, from the cosmic star formation history and the cosmic evolution of black holes across time, and make sure this can explain all the magnetic fields we see. Understanding this is a big part of the scientific challenge of the many radio telescopes that have been deployed over the latest years, and that will culminate all together with the scientific case of the Square Kilometer Array. So, in a nutshell, you can expect these two extremely different scenarios. So, in the primordial case, you expect to have magnetic fields that are just below the current limits from Planck or other CMB probes, and they would stretch and connect to the available limits. On the other extreme, in the astrophysical case, you expect to have instead that the magnetic field are dropping sharply with decreasing over density, because as you exit galaxy cluster, you start missing the galaxies, so the sources of magnetization, and you would start to see magnetic field disappear or drop very fast with radius. And of course, in principle, if I can get a robust measurement of magnetic fields in voids, it's where the two scenarios would diverge more, but of course voids are voids, so it's difficult to imagine many observables from them. And it seems that like the sweet spot is in the regime of filaments, for which we have enough statistics, we might have observables, and we can already find pretty large differences between those two extremely different scenarios. How are we going to study that? So the approach I'm carrying out since the latest decade or so is to use massive numerical simulation in cosmology. You can ask me more if you're interested. In a nutshell, most of our simulations are done with the massively parallel ENSO code, which is a grid code that is supporting, in our case, ideal MHD equations on a comoving grid. It's ideal to resolve shocks and turbulence, but you need a lot of numerical resolution because you need to solve to cover a very large dynamical range. We are combining two approaches, either very large uni-grid fixed resolution simulations covering several hundreds of megaparsec, or adaptive mesh refinement simulation, in which we can crank up the resolution, for example, in single clusters, and we simulate a galaxy cluster at a time still embedded in a much larger environment. This is to show you one nice result out of this, which was also awarded by the NRAO last year as the best visualization in radio astronomy. What you see here is the simulated evolution of a merger and its associated radio emission. All the flashes you see are when we estimate particles. Here is just a sample of particles get shocked via cosmic shocks, and they produce radio emission, which would be the cyan lines. And then we dissolve out into a real structure. This is instead a real observation done with a very large array by a PhD student at the University of Bologna. And this is just to show that to a first order, this kind of simulation already can produce the complexity, the variety of morphologies, even the power. We need to explain some of the observed big radio relics in the sky. We are going to see another one here on the lower part. This is one of the most spectacular. It's called the toothbrush radio relic. That's again a real structure observed with a very large array. And this we can use this approach to calibrate, for example, our model, which is the efficiency of particle acceleration. Is our amplification model for magnetic fields right? Can we explain clusters? And if so, we can stretch and simulate the universe outside of galaxy clusters. So in the same code, we can simulate either purely primordial scenario, either purely astrophysical scenario, compare the differences, for example, on the scale of filaments, go back to real observation, which are complex to model, and try to see if observations already allow us to understand which is the universe we are living in. So what you see here are the two extreme alternatives. On the left, we have a purely primordial seeding scenario, in which we initialize magnetic fields as a blue background, you will see in a few seconds. And on the right, we start with zero magnetic field, and we just let magnetic fields to be injected by a star forming region or AGNs. So the simulation would do like this. On the right, you need to wait for the formation of stars and the peak of star formation history to start enriching the structure with magnetic fields. But if you look at the underlying matter distribution in these two universes, is exactly the same. Magnetic fields do not alter this evolution, but the distribution of magnetic fields in the colors here is entirely different. Those are two extremes. Of course, nature can decide to use a bit of both, or even to have even different seeding methods. In this project, we simulated like so far something like 40 different models for the seeding of magnetic fields in either of the two scenarios, combination by both. And now I'm going to show you how we can try to match observation and interpret them. An important point is this one. So why cannot we use galaxy cluster to study cosmic magnetism? We have already 50 and more galaxy cluster observed at radio wavelength. So the problem is that within galaxy cluster, we expect that dynamo amplification is taking place. If you look at the, okay, I'm sorry for the resolution actually, but if you look at the magnetic fields within clusters, they are very tangled, they evolve very fast. And we think they do that because we know from several approaches that the intracluster medium in galaxy cluster is turbulent, which means there is enough time in the closed system that the galaxy cluster is to take any magnetic field as a seed and to amplify it using like 5% of the turbulent kinetic energy flux of gas motions and make the magnetic fields we observe within galaxy cluster, which means all memory of the seed fields is lost. You can start with pretty much any sort of seed field, 10 to the minus 20, 10 to the minus 10 Gauss. You will always end up having the same final magnetic field because you are only using a seed to like light ideal MHD equations on, but then the energy is finally coming from the turbulent kinetic energy of the gas in the cluster. The opposite is true for filaments. All our theoretical modeling is suggesting they are pretty much dominated just by compression. You don't have turbulence even if you go to high resolution, and gas is continuously flowing across filaments and going towards the nearby clusters. So you don't have giga years to continuously stir magnetic field lines. And so you think that the magnetic field you would see there, maybe it's very tiny, it's difficult to observe, but if you get the signal, you can relate it to the seed magnetic field just inverting the compression relation. You know what is the typical overdensity of a filament, or better, you can measure it if you have like X-ray data, and you can relate any magnetic field signature to the seed field. So that's why also we need, and we hope to detect filaments. Now,
I'm sorry, yeah. Franco, a question in the previous slide. What was the F-turb on the left equation?
Is the kinetic energy flux of turbulent. The one you can get from the...
Okay, flux to kinetic energy, okay.
The thing that basically is conserved in the Kolmogorov model across scales, like is rho vu cubic times a scale, a divided okay. scale.
Okay.
So, small caveat before I move on, I'm trying to fill now this, again, this plane, density over magnetic field, but using real observations. An important disclaimer is that we never have direct limits on B. They can come from, if we are lucky, the Faraday rotation, the synchrotron emission. Most of the time, they do not refer to a single object. They refer to an integral along the line of sight spanning gigaparsecs. So it's very difficult to have direct limits. We can do that through the modeling of simulation that can more or less try to measure the same complexity. But the big caveat is that it's very difficult to get direct limits on B. This is the collections of the latest limits. You can, if you're interested, I did a paper just last year on this subject. So we have the intracluster medium here, but we are not going to use that because, as I said, those limits are not good to study different seeding models. Then we have all these collections of data points. So different flavors of CMB modeling are here. We already mentioned them. You can have variation on top of that, but I'm not going to mention them here. And the Blaeser limits, depending on the samples you are using, are here. Now, let's review shortly what all these other limits here in between are, because those are the latest and the most important for my science here. No, what's that? And I will need to switch slide. Okay, so first limit is this one coming from the non-detections of the signature of synchrotron emission between pairs of galaxy cluster we selected last year. This was work by a PhD student in Bologna. We could not find signature of radio emission here. We can use simulation to understand what would have been the maximum magnetic field in two pairs of filaments, in two pairs of cluster, not to have a detected emission with LOFAR. And we can use this to estimate limits on this ballpark. Magnetic field there should be less than 0.2 and 0.5 microgauss. Then we can have the cross-correlation using the MWA survey between the distribution of galaxies and the distribution of radio emission in the entire MWA survey, and we can derive this upper limit, that's a non-detection as well, referring to a slightly lower density. Then we can have compute the difference in Faraday rotation between different pairs of lobes of radio galaxies just projected randomly in the sky. They have different redshift. Take this one can have redshift 1, this one can have redshift 0.8. If you don't detect a strong difference in Faraday rotation between these two points at this scale, you can use that to limit the amount of Faraday rotation the intergalactic medium can have produced between redshift 1 and 0.8. And you can use that through simulation to infer limits in this ballpark. So we are reaching out. This point is an important one. Or that's even more challenging and more exciting. We think the stacked signal by piling together 300,000 pairs of halos from a galaxy catalog. And then using MWA, you can work out the stacked radio signal. You can remove the one of the two profiles and study the excess. That's the same approach that also the group in Paris by Aghanim and collaborators used to detect, for example, the stacked emission by between filaments in X-ray and SZ. And Tessa Venstrom last year did that in radio at five different frequencies. So we can also compute a spectrum, which is the minus one you would expect from shocks in the universe. And the limit suggests magnetic fields of the order of a few tens of nanogauss, which is on the high side. And we are filling out this region here. Now, which simulated model can best reproduce those data? Oh, why this is continuously showing up? I have no idea. Okay. So now we fill this plane with the real data of simulation. So now I'm color coding the distribution of mass in the simulation for different models. So let's take a model, our best model of the 10 or more we have, including star formation and AGN feedback and linking each episode of feedback to the release of magnetic fields using typically 10% of the feedback energy is released through magnetic dipoles. Can this explain the data? Not very well, because for example, we don't have enough magnetic energy to explain the non-detection of Blaeser emission. You see there is a lot of cells in the simulation which would go below what is allowed by Blaeser limits, and also we fall short, for example, of the stacking emission here, because most of the mass would be here, and we don't explain why the stacking of so many filaments is producing a signal here. So this discrepancy and this one are enough to say this model alone cannot explain the combination of all these data set. Let's assume we have a very low magnetic field in the universe, 10 to the minus 14, the weakest you need to be compatible with Blaser limits here. And let's assume everything is amplified. Whenever there is matter falling into filaments, we allow the field to be amplified as in galaxy clusters. Even if the simulation wouldn't do that, we can allow that through subgrid modeling. In this case, we will produce two large magnetic fields to be compatible with all these limits. Most of the simulation will lie here. We are exceeding the lower limit, sorry, the upper limit from those statistical observations. Let's use a strong primordial magnetic field, basically the highest, 1 nanogauss you can use because of Planck. The problem is that we are also exceeding, like the stacking experiment, we are exceeding the difference in Faraday rotation between radio galaxies, so that's too large, getting closer to maybe what's the reality. If we start with a 10 to the minus 10 gauss, so 0.1 nanogauss, we start being compatible, we still struggle to reproduce this limit. Now, this is more difficult to understand from a plot like this, but we really did the stacking of object extracted from the simulation, like extracting all different possible filaments in this simulation. And once you do that, you still fall short of the stacking limit. So there is something more compared to this model that is adding, say, more fluctuation to the model than what we see. And a possible solution would be this one. Since last year, we started simulating really tangled magnetic fields, so we don't start with a flat, uniform, spatial uniform magnetic field. We allow the existence of power spectral distribution of magnetic fields, as you can expect from inflation, in which case you expect spectra in which most of the energy is on the left side, large scale, or conversely, causal, I'm almost done, by the way, causal mechanism in which most of the energy is piling up at small scales, because those are mechanisms happening after inflation that can only happen within the horizon. All these magnetic models we use were worked out by Paoletti and Finelli to be compatible with Planck limits. So they were really doing modeling of the CMB. I just plug them in the simulation and run it until redshift zero. So what's interesting is that in that case, having a tangled field which can be compatible with Planck limits allow you to do a much better job in going through most of these, actually all these limits. And this is what is happening, I guess. Do we see it here? Okay, so what you see is a tangled magnetic field which is still going to be advected into galaxy cluster, in filaments, etc., but you still remain with a lot of fluctuations in the voids or in filaments, because the initial field was tangled. This would boost the Faraday rotation and would give you more fluctuations in synchrotron emission, because it's the field itself that is initially having fluctuations. And since synchrotron is boosting B squared, this would enhance statistically the emission you can get from the same model. Otherwise, if you have a uniform magnetic field, it's difficult to get some of the limits right. So at the moment, this seems to be the best guess. So a primordial magnetic field, which has a power spectrum of distribution in this ballpark, with spectral indices in this ballpark, so still an inflationary one, seems to be the best one giving, going through all available upper, lower limits for detection. Of course, in the future, if any of these upper limits become a detection, we can still reject this model. At the moment, this is just the most compatible with everything we have. And this would be the entire view, and what you see, all this fluctuation in green are the different patches of magnetic field you are across the domain. The near future, something we are missing is to inject also radio galaxies in a very consistent way across the domain, because we need to reproduce, for example, the observed distribution of radio galaxies, which is difficult, and this can change a little bit the prediction for the astrophysical models. And I'm done. Those are my conclusions. So we don't yet know the origin of cosmic magnetism. We expect that the seed fields and their signature can still be available for observations, even if it can be challenging on the scale of filaments. We need a complicated combination of simulation and observation to extract the information of B out of the other players, like relativistic electron density, topology of magnetic fields, and so on. And at the moment, our best guess is that available data are suggesting a possibly inflationary origin scenario for most of the magnetic fields we see. And this is the picture, the ensemble picture of my group and all the people that hardly contributed to this. And I'm a bit long. Please ask me anything.
No, don't worry, Franco. Thank you. We started later. You're, I want to say, perfectly on time with respect to our usual schedule. Thank you for your very nice talk. I really appreciate it. I remind that a hint by an old professor of physics I had, who said that if you have a problem, if you want to avoid any problem, introduce magnetic fields in your equations. And it seems that it is the case. Well, is there any... Yeah. Is there any comment or question? I have a couple of questions. Maybe I can start very unrelated questions. The first one is about the can you say a bit more about the inflationary model of magnetic fields? How are they produced by some inflationary model? Is the magnetic field a Gaussian field? What's the physics behind the magnetic field produced in the real time?
Okay, so this is probably the part I know less of everything I said.
Well, just
because I'm not an expert myself of the production of magnetic fields during inflation. So they are convenient. Yeah, ask him. No, they are very convenient because, of course, if you have something happening before inflation, this can, even in a Gaussian way, give basically the same very large current scales on scales larger than the horizon. The difficulty is basically you have to break conformal invariance of magnetic field to explain, to overcome the extreme dilution a magnetic field generating before inflation should undergo after the inflation itself. So it's something is not easy to explain, because otherwise whatever you generate before inflation is going to be super fast diluted, while everything we show here must have after inflation something at least of the order of 10 to the minus 14 Gauss commoving. Otherwise, we will have problem with blazers, for example.
You say that they are diluted because they are a vector field, and every vector field decreases with 1 over the redshift, roughly?
So the magnetic field post-inflation would decay as, would evolve like 1 plus Z squared. So if you apply the expansion factor you have during inflation, you will have something entirely negligible. And even if it's there, it would be much more negligible than other mechanisms that have been proposed, which I didn't mention, like Biermann battery, etc., that can contribute to some of the magnetic field we observe. And all the range of different lines you see here are not coming from different theoretical prediction. Those are all magnetic field power spectra that are allowed by the modeling of Planck and Bicep limits. I don't think there is a theory that can explain any of these fields quantitatively. You can just explain the shape, but not the normalization. The normalization is the maximum allowed by Planck. And as far as I know, there are very nice reviews by Subramanian, Bacciaspati, many more people. You really have 20 orders of magnitude in uncertainty on what you can do, for example, during inflationary generation of magnetic fields. But if we can give them some narrower range of values, this, I hope, can boost the theory in that sense. But we are a bit far from that, but maybe
okay, that's good. So, thank you. And the second question is totally unrelated. Very likely not so related to your strict work. I am interested by the observation that the PhD students did at VLA. Which kind of observations are how long?
It was Loffer. If you're speaking of this. No, sorry, this one. I'm sorry that the quality of the image is bad, but okay, it's a non-detection anyway. So, well, there's not much to see because it is a non-detection anyway. Those are two, this is one of the two objects we observe, and those are 8 hours LOFAR exposures, which is of the order of what you have in the survey, actually, yeah, is exactly the same exposures you have in the survey. Actually, in LOFAR, you can ask to point a field with the same exposure you have in the survey, and this is added on top of the survey, which is still ongoing. So it's 8 hours, and this is 120 megahertz. And
is it a reasonable time for this instrument?
You can go deeper, but for example, with the same amount of hours, you could see the bridge, the bridge between ABLE 399-401 I showed at the beginning. So of course one can go deeper and deeper, but this is already what you get in the survey, and this is already showing, I mean, plenty of diffuser emission. So in order to know exactly what is the maximum magnetic field we have there, we need to inject it on the measurement set of LOFAR, templates of the possible filament emission we have from simulations between similar pairs of clusters. And then Nicola, the student, redid all the analysis and tried to understand what was the maximum magnetic field he could just renormalize in post-processing before getting a detection. And that's the way in which we got this limit. You can go deeper, of course, but even if you go a factor 10 deeper, I think the limit is going to increase only by factor 3, something like that.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you. Katarina, you have a question? You raise your hand, please.
Yes, very interesting talk. Thanks. I have two questions that are scale related. So first one is concerning more large scales. So when you are showing these nice filaments in your simulations and the magnetic field, so I was wondering whether you measure the orientation of the magnetic field vector with respect to the filaments. Is there any preferred orientation? Like, for example, is the magnetic field preferentially perpendicular to the filaments? Or
yes, this is interesting stuff. Yeah, I didn't mention it here, but it's a part of another PhD student work. It's in the hidden slides. Let me see if by any chance I can find it. This is the one. So yes, there is a preferential direction. I don't have much more than this, but so the works is by Banfi et al. It has been already accepted in the meanwhile. So she measured basically how the magnetic field lines would correlate with the direction of the spine of filaments, at least in the cleanest filaments we have in the simulation. And the very interesting thing we found is that regardless of the origin scenarios of magnetic field, this would be, for example, four different models. In all cases, you can measure this alignment, or say the angle between magnetic field lines and the spine of the filament. And very interestingly, we find that magnetic fields tend to always align with the spine of the filament, regardless of their origin. And this is basically because of the way in which the gas flow is accreting onto filaments. So no matter what are the seeds of magnetic field, you often find that magnetic fields are aligning parallel to the filament, even if not all currently. They can have reversals, of course. Which means that most of the shocks that are surrounding filaments, since shocks would move this direction and filaments would orient almost perpendicular, most of the shocks would be quasi-perpendicular, which is a nice feature because we know how to accelerate electrons in quasi-perpendicular shocks. We don't know how to accelerate electrons in quasi-parallel shocks, at least in this regime of Mach numbers. So it's interesting because it seems that if you go even like 1 megaparsec from the center of a filament, no matter what the origin of magnetic field, the gas flow would rearrange them to be quasi-perpendicular, okay, respect to shocks. And this is also important because if you observe them through Faraday rotation, it means that if you put filaments on the plane on the sky, the magnetic field lines, if simulations are correct, are not entirely randomly put before respect to you. They would align on the plane in the sky, which means that the Faraday rotation you would get is underestimating quite a lot by a factor 3 the real magnetic field strength, which seems to be preferentially aligned with the filament itself. So in that case, usually observers would put, like in the stacking experiment I showed, you would take two halos, put them on, I mean, at a short distance, I mean, select pairs of halos at a short distance, hope they are lying on the plane on the sky, and think this is the best configuration to study the emission in between. This is true, but it is not the best configuration to study Faraday rotation. You can have huge mismatch between the Faraday rotation, the magnetic field you would infer through Faraday rotation or synchrotron for the same object, just because the topology is not random. It has some preferential alignment. If simulations are true, it's difficult to validate it, but this is what they show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, super interesting. Thank you. And if I may, a second quick question, more related to smaller scales and more related to galaxy evolution, whatever. So, what is the I don't know if you have measured this, if this is of your interest, but what would be the impact measured or expected of this magnetic field on galaxy properties? Is that a positive or negative feedback of or any kind of?
So I didn't measure it myself because we don't crank up the resolution yet to.
But in those zooms, for example, in those zoom, still you don't have enough resolution even in.
Those zooms are very good for galaxy cluster, but still not for galaxies. I know from other groups, for example, there's a group studying. With Lustris, for example, and they show that for magnetic fields larger than, for initial magnetic fields larger than, I guess, 10 nanogauss, which is already larger than what you would limit with Planck anyway, you would affect the cosmic star formation history in a negative way. So the magnetic pressure would hamper the formation of stars, and you would delay quite a lot the star formation histories. Or other works by the group of Kanyashvili et al. Have shown that very low masses galaxies, like below, I think, 10 to the minus 8, if you have magnetic fields larger than still the limits we would anyway exclude nowadays because of Planck, but this was before the Planck limits, if you have magnetic fields larger than a few nanogauss, you would also basically hamper the formation of the lowest mass galaxies. So because magnetic fields have tensions, and especially if they are coherent, they can really quench the formation of galaxies or quench the formation of stars, depending on what's the amplitude and what are the scales of those fields. So as far as I can tell, always negative impact, as far as I can
tell. Adding a pressure against the collapse, right, and preventing the...
Yes. Current. But all those fields basically can be already excluded now also based on Planck limits. So you don't expect to have very large effect of magnetic fields. Then if you look at things in detail, like the effect of feedback, if the winds is magnetized or not, this would change. But in that case, those would be, of course, not primordial fields, but coming from galaxy formation.
Yeah, I think that this would have a more impact. I sort of agree that on large scales, probably we still can answer in conferences that what about magnetic fields? Well, we don't include it. It doesn't really matter. But I think where it starts to matter, it's on the scales of galaxies, where you start to model, for example, the cosmic rays, where obviously interaction with the magnetic field and then the impact on galaxy properties should be huge.
Thank you
very much. Very interesting.
I didn't mention, because I know it's controversial and I'm not an expert, having a 0.1 nanogauss as a primordial field has been suggested as a possible solution for the H0 tension, for example, but I'm not really an expert, because this would change the scale of basically recombination and would change the scale of distance in the universe. But it was interesting, but I'm not an expert on that. You can have cosmological implication of that level, even if not on the dynamics of structures, but I think it's a controversial.
Interesting. Thank you.
Athanasia, you raised the hand. Yes, please. Athanasia, you're muted. You raised the hand, you lowered the hand. So maybe your question has been already answered. I guess this is the case. Is there any message on the chat? No message on the chat. Okay, if there are no other questions or comments, we can stop here. Thank you Franco for your talk. Very nice. I hope to meet you somewhere physically soon. Why not in Bologna? Next week, I don't remember the seminar of the next week. I'm not using my laptop in this moment, so I'm not able to find the title of next week's seminar. But it is already listed on the web page. So see you next week, and bye bye.